Today's shiur is sponsored by Eli Newman for the continued success of Tiferes Bnei Torah of Queens.
Today we have the diehards Memorial Day weekend, you know, and people come out Sunday morning. It's pretty chashuv, so I better be good today. You know, they used to tell a joke about the Chachmei HaMusar that, you know, they would take the various characters in Tanakh and analyze them, Alpi Musar, and you'd start with an individual who appears to be a Rasha, and they come up with all the explanations and all the things, and by the time you finish, they turn the Rasha into a Tzaddik. Then they take the person who appears to be a Tzaddik, and they find all the flaws, and they turn him into a Rasha. So they asked him, listen, if you're in the train station, this goes back a few years, if you're in the train station and you have to use the facilities and you need to ask somebody to watch your suitcase, so who are you going to ask? This tzaddik that you claimed was a Rasha, or this Rasha that you claimed was really a tzaddik? So, you know, last week we turned Adoniel into a tzaddik. He said, you know, he had such a following. Now we're going to have to go through the rebellion of Adoniel and turn him back into a Rasha. You know, there were serious tainus on him after everything is said and done, despite the milus and the attributes and the greatness that he possessed. He went seriously astray, and we will see a little bit as we go through the psukim what happened. So Adoniel was proclaiming himself the king. Adoniel ben Chagias. Chagias was his mother's name. Misnase lemor, ani emloch, I will be king. Vayasla rechav uparashim, he made himself chariots and horsemen. The chamishim ish ratzim lefanav, and 50 people running in front of him. This is the trappings of royalty. What he did was, he behaved in a manner that normally was done by kings. This was the protocol for kings. And, you know, he had all the secret service agents and the limos and the motorcade. And as if he were the king. It is not clear from the pasuk, and many mafarshim say that Adoniel never actually beferish said that he's king. Misnase lemar ni emloch, I will be king. Right? He elevated himself saying ani emloch, I will be king. So technically what he did was not an outright rebellion against David HaMelech, which is why initially Shlomo was ready to spare his life. And it was only after in a second attempt at the kingdom that he got rid of Adoniel. So he never actually proclaimed himself to be the king right now, only declaring himself to be the heir apparent. It was the people, as we'll see later in the report, that proclaimed him the king right away. You know, sometimes you start something and it gets out of hand a bit. And that appears what happened with Adoniel. And the pasuk goes on and says, "V'lo atzavo aviv miyamav lemar." His father never got him upset by saying, "Madua kachos." He said, "Why are you doing this?" He never was the subject of severe criticism from his father to the point that it would get him upset. V'gam hu tov tar ma'od, and he was also very handsome. V'osa yod acharei Avshalom, and he was born after Avshalom. It's a very strange pasuk. We're discussing Adoniel's rebellion. All of a sudden, we're talking about his history, we're talking about his looks, we're talking about his yichus. What's going on? So, there are two fundamental approaches to this pasuk. Most of the Rishonim, with the possible exception of the Radak, or at least partial exception of the Radak, learn that this pasuk is a little bit of a psychoanalysis of the reasons why what brought Adoniel to the point of entertaining such a revolution. What was it about the character and the makeup of Adoniel that caused him to do such a thing? So the first thing is, he was never subject to discipline. And we mentioned before as to why David didn't do this. David thought that he didn't need it, but the fact is that everybody needs it. And as a result of the fact that he was not subject to discipline, he went off. How? the simple understanding would be it caused him to be a Bhagaiva, it caused him to be arrogant, it caused him to have too high an opinion of himself. One of the Mefarshim says it caused him to believe that his judgment was always correct. If Dovin never criticized me, then that's because I'm really pretty good at this stuff. And since in his judgment he was right to be king, he assumed that he was obviously right, as he has always been right. In education, by the way, this is an interesting dilemma. I've heard many times from the Rosh Yeshiva that a teacher has to be very careful when you have a gifted student not to overdo the praise, not to, you know, the gifted student is always getting the highest scores and is always getting all the attention, and he could easily walk away with the impression that he's always right and could create gaiva, and you have to be careful, you have to balance that. So there's a story told about Ramosha Feinstein when he was a child, that he was already a very gifted child, and one time his father was a Rav, and was being, the other Chasher Rabbanim were visiting his father and were discussing some difficult child, and Ramosha must have been whatever he was, 11 or 12 years old at the time, and Ramosha had a teretz, and he answered the question. They all very impressed with this young child's answer. Later, Ramosha, or he wasn't Ramosha yet, he was a little Moshele, came into the room, and the Rabban stood up for him. Said Ramosha's father had a fit, as we would say today, went ballistic, started shouting at the other Rabban, "What are you doing to my son? Are you trying to kill him?" Meaning, you give him all this kavod that you could ruin him. So Ramosha, of course, heard this exchange, and it made an impression on him. He was the one who told over that story later. But so you have to be careful. The Metzudas, David adds an interesting twist. He says, "Bavrezeh chashiv shekol ma'asav hagunim v'roi hu l'melucha." Because he was never criticized, he thought that his actions were proper, and he was roi to be the king. So the Metzudas makes it a much more direct link. It's not a question of a psychological reason. Since I was never criticized, I grew up in a certain way, and I think I'm great, I think I'm right. He took it almost as a direct endorsement. If David never criticized me, and he criticized the other children, clearly David is saying that I am better than the other children. So if that's the case, I should be king. So it was actually David's lack of criticism in him, which he took, according to the Metzudas, as a direct endorsement, implication that he should be king. So that's stage one. La'atzava Aviv either psychologically caused him to be a Bhagaiva, caused him to think that he was right, or even directly, according to the Metzudas, this was an implicit indication by David that he was the greatest of all the children. Second thing, he was handsome. So, again, some of Farshim learned that this is also a question of gaiva. A person who's handsome, good-looking, there are studies done today, they do studies about everything today. And they show that, you know, they tend to be leaders of the class and so on. People, you know, who gravitate towards good-looking people. So therefore, it caused him to be a Bhagaiva. Interestingly, there are those who interpret it that he thought this was a legitimate reason to be king. And it makes a certain amount of sense. In the enumeration of the qualities of a Navi, one of the things mentioned is that a Navi should be tall. Why does a Navi have to be tall? Everything is learned from Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe Rabbeinu was tall. But Moshe Rabbeinu's name was Moshe. We don't say a Navi has to be named Moshe. So it has to be a significant factor. When somebody is tall, people listen to them. You know, there's something intimidating about a tall person. People tend to listen. And the same thing is true when somebody is good looking. People tend to pay attention to them. It could be that's why JFK won the election. There is something about that. And therefore, he felt that it was a factor. I'm better looking than Shlomo is. And therefore, people will listen to me. A king has to be somebody that people will listen to. And this is a weakness in human nature. We tend to be attracted by external things. The Rabag, by the way, in his Toalios, when he mentions the various different lessons we learn, says one of the lessons we learn from this story is not to be attracted by the outside appearance, to resist that human tendency. Somebody is handsome, somebody is tall, somebody has a certain appearance, not to be fooled by that, but to look beyond that and see what the person is really made out of. And then the third factor in the pasuk is also Yod Acharei Avshalom. He was the next one born after Avshalom. Basically, what this means is that he was the oldest living child of David HaMelech. Avshalom was killed. There were actually other brothers who were older, but if you go through the Cheshbonos and Divrei HaYamim, it would appear, or it could be, that they were all dead at this time. So Avshalom was the oldest living son of David, and therefore the oldest son is entitled to the Melucha. By the way, it raises a question: if that's true, why didn't he get the Melucha? If the oldest son is entitled to the Melucha, then why didn't he get it? And of course, the easy way out is to say, well, there was a Nevuah, Kadosh Baruch Hu's decision. Kadosh Baruch Hu said that Shlomo should be the king. One could also answer, and maybe this is the reason why Kadosh Baruch Hu said this, is because ultimately he really was not Roy to be king. The concept, we have a sort of modified form of Yerusha when it comes to, for Kohen Gadol is the same thing, a Melech. Unfortunately, in real life, it doesn't always play out that way. But there is a Tzchus of Yerusha, but the Yoresh has to be Roy, has to be appropriate for the position. So if David would have had, let's say, Apihuchus Yerusha, if David would have had two sons, an older son and a younger son, and they were both Roy to be king, even if the younger son was better equipped, but as long as the older son was also equipped, he would be entitled to Kadima. But if you're not equipped, then you have no such right. And this is learned from the Pasuk by Kohen Gadol. It says, Asher Yimalei Es Yodo L'Chayin Tachas Aviv. So since it says L'Chayin Tachas Aviv, we learn that the son of a Kohen Gadol has the right to be a Yoresh, to be the Kohen Gadol when the father dies. But it says Yimalei Es Yodo, his hand will be filled, meaning that he has to be Roy for the position. If he's Roy and there are other people who are also Roy, the son comes first. But if he's not Roy, then he isn't entitled to the position. It doesn't fully answer the question, though. The problem is not so much what's going on now, but what happened earlier. David HaMelech promised Bathsheba that her son would be king before Shlomo was even born. How could he possibly have known at that time that the older sons, he didn't even know which ones would be alive when he died, but that the older sons were not right to be king, and that Shlomo would be right to be king. In fact, one of the older sons who died, goes by various different names, Kilov, perhaps Daniel. Kilov is mentioned in the Gemara as one of the four people who died only because of the sin of Adam and Risha. Did not have enough sin on his own, right, to be worthy of death. The Amram, the father of Moshe, was one. Binyamin from the Shvatim was one. Yishai, David's father, and Kilov, David's son. So he was a pretty great person too. He was no longer alive at this time, but David didn't know that before Shlomo was born. And I think you really have to say there are other Maimori Chazal that state that the reason why David wanted to marry Bathsheba in the first place was because he saw Ruach HaKodesh, that he was destined to have children from her that were going to be king. It must be that he relied on that, because it would seem, I didn't see anybody who says this outright, but it would seem that according to logic, there's no way he could have made such a judgment before the child was born. Right, so this is one approach to the pasuk, that these three factors, Lo Atzavo, Tov Toar, and also Yolda, were the reasons that motivated Adon Yotra Bel, that made him think that he was worthy of being a king. There are those who read the pasuk as a strategy. The Radak really says this only on the first point of the pasuk, not the others, but there are other later Mefarshim who say, interpret the entire pasuk this way. We mentioned this before, that Adoniel had to make a strategic decision. He wanted to be king. He apparently was aware of the fact that David intended Shlomo to be king. It's not clear whether he knew about the Nevuah as well. Some Mefarshim say he did. So if he knew the Nevuah, for sure he knew he had to deal with this. But even without that, he clearly knew that Shlomo was destined to be king. And the biggest proof is that when he made his party, he did not invite Shlomo or any of the people that were close to Shlomo. So he had to figure out his strategy. He wants to be king. David wants Shlomo to be king. How is he going to pull this off? The safest strategy would have been to be quiet, get support, still a hate, behind the scenes, get Yoav on his side, get Avias on his side, whoever else he could manage, wait till David HaMelech dies, and then proclaim himself king. Shlomo's going to say he's king. All right. So Shlomo said, David wanted me to be king. Adoniel said, no, David wanted me to be king. And I have Yoav on my side, Avias on my side, and then, you know, make a run for it, fight for it, see who prevails. You know, they tell the story about the Rebbe that was Nifter, and he had two sons were vying for the to take over. And, you know, somewhere on one side, somewhere on the other side, finally one son comes and says, you know, our father appeared to me in a dream and said that I should be the leader. So the other son said, if our father really wanted you to be the leader, he should have appeared to me in a dream. Once David is no longer there to contradict him, he can make whatever claim he wants, and you know, he has a good chance. Maybe some will prevail, maybe he'll prevail. If he's got Yoav and Avias on his side, he's got a pretty powerful entourage. Okay, some has his people, see who wins. What Adoniel did was he rolled the dice. Adoniel's strategy was to proclaim himself the future king while David HaMelech was still alive, and to make a big taharan and make a big public scene, hoping that David wouldn't say anything, just as he hadn't said anything before. And if that happens, then he would really be in the driver's seat, because nobody would believe Shlomo that David wanted him to be king. He didn't say anything. Everyone heard that Adoniel is king. David's still alive. He didn't say a word. Clearly, David agreed. And if that would have in fact happened, Adoniel felt, and Yoav and Avyatsar, who were apparently advising him, felt that it would be a sure thing. But it's a huge gamble, because it is so easy to defeat him. If he wins, he'll have the upper hand, he'll probably be able to defeat Shlomo. But if David does say something, which is in fact what happened, makes a public proclamation, it's all over. Because while David is alive, nobody is going to support Adoniel. David had the loyalty of Kal Yisrael. So he took the gamble. And according to the Radak, the reason why he took this gamble is because he counted on this psychological, you might say, weakness of David. If David never criticized me, if he thinks I'm so great, he loves me so much, then maybe he won't be able to bring himself to criticize me now either. Well, Atzava David Miyamav, he never did it until now. So I could rely on the fact that Ahava Mikalkelas Es Ashura, a person's excessive love can distort his judgment. And David will come up with some excuse not to criticize me now. And based on that calculation, he was ready to take the risk. It's a tremendous insight into human nature, because it was such a big risk, and he could have so easily gone down, which in fact he did. And he knew that David HaMelech had sworn a shvuah to give the melucha to Shlomo HaMelech. And at least according to some Mefarshim, the Radak himself says that he knew the nevuah. And Yoav and Avyasa knew this too. And all these people felt that they had better odds tempting fate, so to speak, proclaiming himself king now, relying on this Ava Mekalkeles Es Ashura, the distortion of David's judgment, rather than taking the chances in a fair fight with Shlomo Lachem Mises David. And I think we see from here how susceptible, how vulnerable we are to this kind of distortion. Even David HaMelech, who was a great tzaddik, and I'm sure Adoniel appreciated the greatness of David HaMelech, is susceptible to this. And we have to be careful, you know, when we get involved in situations with somebody who's close to us, somebody we love, you know, whether it's a spouse, it's a child, it's a parent, it's a close friend, and we're sure that we're right, and we're sure that our approach is correct, but Ahava Mekalkelet Es Hashur, it's a very, very distorting lens with which we view the world. And you have to be very careful. If this was a reasonable gamble for Adoniyahu Yovav Yosef to take, it must be that it's a very powerful force, and that even as great a person as David HaMelech, there's a very good chance that he will fall prey to this and find some reason, some excuse not to criticize Adoniyahu. It didn't quite work out that way, but it was worth the gamble. Continuing with this approach to the Pasuk, again, the Radak himself doesn't appear to continue that way, but others do. The Malbim and other later people do. You could read the rest of the Pasuk also as a strategy. That Adoniyahu thought that he would prevail because he was Tov Toar, and therefore he could make a good argument to the people, or at least the people, I don't know if it's an argument to the people, but the people would be swept up by his other arguments, and he was the oldest. So therefore he deserves to be king. Now it's a little bit peculiar that it says, V'oso yilad acharei Avshalom, like why are we mentioning Avshalom here? If the only reason was to tell you that Adoniyahu was the oldest, so say so. Adoniyahu was the oldest of all the children. Not that he was born after Avshalom. And the truth of the matter is that although he was born after Avshalom, the next child after Avshalom, there were other brothers who were older than Avshalom. So we had mentioned that they were dead by now, but okay, that's not indicated in the pasuk. The simple way would have been to say he was the oldest living son of David. So Rashi notes the connection, and Rashi says that there was a connection between Avshalom and Adoniyahu. So the Acharei Avshalom, first also Yolda Imo, his mother, Acharei Avshalom, Klomar Gadlaso Achar Tarbus Shegadlo Imo Shel Avshalom. Adoniyahu's mother raised Adoniyahu in the same way that Avshalom's mother raised Avshalom. Before we were blaming the father, now we're blaming the mother. The cause for Adoniyahu's going off was the way that his mother raised him. Now, we don't get details. We don't know exactly what they did. But it seems that the mother of Adoniyahu followed in the footsteps of the mother of Avshalom. I would suggest that that might be why his mother's name is mentioned in the first place. In Pasuk Hey, it says Adoniyahu ben Chagis. Why is it necessary for us to tell us his mother's name at this point? It could be that this is the reason, to be merami to what Rashi says later, that the mother was the cause of his downfall. How does this fit in with the Chazal and for the Rishonim who learned that they blame it on David? David did not criticize Adoniyahu. So you know how it goes. They blame everybody. It's the mother and the father. But I think the Hesber is that David's problem was passive. But the mother, Chagis' problem was active. In other words, Chagis did certain things in his upbringing that messed up, so to speak, Adoniyahu. What David did was he failed to correct it. David didn't do anything, bekum vaseh, in a positive manner that distorted Adoniyahu's upbringing. But in those opportunities where he could have criticized him, he didn't, and that failed to put him in check. What that really means is that even if you do make mistakes in bringing up your child, they're correctable. You know, there is a little bit sometimes of this type of obsessiveness or panic. You know, if you do something wrong, the kid is ruined for life. It doesn't work like that. It takes a concerted effort. You need the mother and the father. You need over time. An individual mistake does not ruin a child's life. But an accumulation of mistakes can. So, of course, it doesn't absolve the child. The child still has bechira and can overcome it, but it makes his challenge more difficult. pasuk continues, "Vayiu devarav im Yoav ben Tzruya." His words were with, meaning accepted by Yoav ben Tzruya, v'mev Yasser haKohen, and with Eviyasa the Kohen, Vayazu Acharei Adonio, and they assisted Adonio. Speaking of mothers, by the way, Tzruya was Yoav's mother. Yoav ben Tzruya, you think Tzruya was his father, Tzruya was Yoav's mother, Tzruya was David HaMelech's sister. Yoav was his nephew. And the reason why he's always referred to as Yoav ben Tzruya, because that was his yichus. His father was just an average guy, but his mother was David HaMelech's sister. Now, how do we understand Yoav and Eviyasar joining Adonio? So Rashi explains that they both had very significant motives to follow Adonio. Yoav knew that David had it in for him. Right? He had violated David's explicit orders, and David was very upset with him. At one point, David tried to get rid of him, wasn't able to do so, but he had a pretty strong sense that when David passed away, he was going to give instructions to take care of him, which is what did happen. And when we get to those sukkim, if we ever make it there, we'll have to understand why David waited until he died. If David felt that Yoav needed to be eliminated, he should have done it himself. But Yoav had that sense of premonition that his days were numbered in the reign of Shlomo. Eviyasar had been the Kohen Gadol, but at a certain point in time, the Urim V'Tumim stopped responding to him. And he knew that the likelihood was that when Shlomo became king, he would appoint a different Kohen Gadol. And this was really a fulfillment of the curse to the household of Eli. Eviyasar was a descendant of Eli, and Eli was a Kohen Gadol, but it was predicted that the Kohen Gadol would be removed from his household, and Eviyasar realized that this was about to happen. So they had motives. If they help Adoniyahu, so obviously Adoniyahu would keep them in their positions. But I don't believe that we could interpret, again, this is the Bala Musar part of me speaking, I don't think that we could interpret this in such conspiratorial terms, that Yoav figured, hey, listen, I'm going to die, so let me figure out a way, if I can get Adoniyahu in, I'll save my life. And yes, I want to keep the Kohen Gadol, it's a very honorable position, let me get Adoniyahu in. On a conscious level, I would have to believe that they really thought that Adoniyahu should be king. We're dealing with great tzaddikim. Here's where we turn the Rishonim into tzaddikim. It says, Yoav, we mentioned before, was such a great person that his loss devastated Kal Yisrael. There was nothing to replace him. So such great people don't engage in such type of conspiracies. Rather, what happened was that his judgment was distorted. We call this a negia. When a person has an ulterior motive, it colors the way he thinks. I call it the first base syndrome. If anybody ever played a pickup baseball game, and there's a close play at first base, so every so often an argument ensues, was he safe or was he out? So who says he's safe? The runner. Who says he's out? The first baseman. Now, according to the laws of statistics, one would think that if there's going to be an argument 50% of the time, it should be the other way around. The first baseman should think that he's out, and the runner should think that he's out, and the first baseman should think that he's safe. Are we dealing with dishonest people? These guys are friends. They're playing a pickup baseball game. There's no money on the line. Such dishonest people? Well, how come it doesn't work out the other way? Isn't that dishonest? That's the way they saw it. Because you see things the way you want to see things. The runner wants to be safe. He really thinks he's safe. He's not lying. At least he's not lying to anybody else. Maybe he's lying to himself. But that's the way he saw things. First baseman saw that he was out. That is the nature of a human being. We can distort reality based on our negias, based on what we'd like to see. And I think that's what happened with Yoav and Eviyasar. As Chazal say, they had a powerful negiah, but they were trying to reach the truth. But they saw things the way they wanted to see things. One of the great challenges in life is to overcome that, because obviously that's not such an easy thing to do. if you really think this is the right way to go, so how are you able to tell that you're wrong? So Maseiros Yesharim says that a person has to examine his deeds, and there's two kinds of mistakes that a person can make. A person is compared to somebody wandering in the dark. You could wander in the dark and stumble on something because you didn't see it. But sometimes in the dark you could see something and think it's something else. You look at an amud, a pole, and you think it's a person. You look at a person and you think it's a pole. So that's this kind of distorted thinking. But it's possible to overcome it by really examining your motives, examining your deeds, trying to be sincere about it, and coming up with the truth. There are other eights too, but I have to save them for the various different chances we'll get to speak about them later. So Rabbah points out something very interesting. He says, in this story you see a little bit of the Derech Hashem in terms of the Hashgacha of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. The fact of the matter is, HaKadosh Baruch Hu wanted to get rid of Yoav and Avyasa. How do we know that? Because in the end, that's what happened. So clearly, HaKadosh Baruch Hu wanted it. So look how things came about. Adon Yoav makes his rebellion, Yoav and Avyasar join him, and that gives Shlomo the tools, the opportunity to give each one their appropriate faith. So you see how HaKadosh Baruch Hu brings everything together to achieve the results that he wants. Moreover, the Rabbah adds that you see in the Adon Yoav that the clever strategies that Adon Yoav employed in order to ensure his victory were the actual things that brought his downfall. Right? They call it the ironic reversal. Had he not made this whole fuss and gotten Yoav and gotten Avyasar and made a public statement, then maybe he would have succeeded. It's only because of this that it attracted David's attention, that David publicly proclaimed Shlomo king while he was still alive, and that's what led to Adoniah's failure. So when you try to be too smart, when you try to outsmart HaKadosh Baruch Hu's plan, the very things that you do are turned against you, bring your downfall. Conversely, the other way around, when you follow Das Torah and you follow what Hashem does, things that would appear to bring your downfall turn out to be the source of your success. There's a classic example of this. I heard this from the Rosh Hashiva, pointed it out, the Gemara in Megillah. It's interesting that the two Gemaras are actually on the same Amud. But I guess it didn't really matter. You could have said it anyway. The Gemara says, V'chol yom v'yom Mordechai mishalech l'pnei chatzar beis ha-melech l'da'at ha-shlom eser mo yos haba. What was going on there? If you realize, we mentioned this before, that people were hiding from Achashverosh. And he had to send out soldiers to find the women and bring them to the palace. Do you think he found everybody? I'm sure many, many people were successful in hiding from the king. So Mordechai said, Esther is such a tzaddikah, she didn't have the chusim to be able to hide successfully and not be found? Such a small nace, and she wasn't roifed, it doesn't make sense. If she was taken to the king's palace, the Kadosh Baruch Hu must have a plan for her. So he was going every day to see Ma Ye'otzeba, what's going to be, what is the Kadosh Baruch Hu's plan? Kadosh Baruch Hu must want Esther in the king's palace. A little bit later, the Gemara says, "Ve'ein Esther Magedes es Malata." Right? She didn't say who she was. This is Mordechai's idea. Why? Because if you don't, once the women were caught and brought to the palace, everyone would brag about how great they are. Because if you're there already, you want to win. Esther had a great yichud. She was a direct descendant of Shaul HaMelech, so she actually was a descendant of royalty. Don't say your family. They may think that you come from a family of robbers, thieves. Maybe they'll think you're illegitimate, and you're not right to be a queen, and they'll throw you out. So, under all circumstances, Esther refused to say who she was. So, she asked, now, wait a second. Didn't you just tell me, that you realize that Kadosh Baruch Hu has a plan for Esther to be in the king's palace, and now you're giving her advice how to get out? What's going on? And the answer is, we leave it to HaKadosh Baruch Hu to run the world. It's not our job to run the world, it's our job to do what's right. And the right thing for Esther to do is try to avoid being forced to live with this guy. That's the halacha. That's what the Torah tells you. If HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants Esther to be in the king's palace, you could be pretty sure that Esther will be in the king's palace. But let HaKadosh Baruch Hu take care of it. Our job is to do what the Torah says. Then HaKadosh Baruch Hu will see and take care of history the way he wants to take care of history. So what happened? Of course it didn't help for Esther to be Magadis Mulatita. She was chosen queen anyway. But where it did help was that was the source of the ultimate geula. Because Haman did not know that Esther was Jewish. And he was caught by surprise when Esther pleaded on behalf of Kaisel, and he did not have a chance to defend himself. If Haman would have known that Esther was Jewish, he would have been smart. He wouldn't have. He either would have gotten rid of Esther first, he would have done things to take care of it. Haman was no fool. But he got blindsided. Because Esther didn't tell who she was. So, by doing something which seemed to be a strategy or a tactic to make Esther less effective, maybe she won't even be selected queen, turns out that was one of the very important factors in the ultimate Yeshua. I'll tell you a more modern story in a lesser scale, but an interesting thing. I heard this story about third hand. Unfortunately, I forgot all the names. I remember the name of the person who told me the story. He heard the story from a mishulach who was staying in his house. The story happened to a friend of this mishulach. So, you know, that's the... But I can't remember any of the names except the guy who told me the story. I don't know if he wants his name used. We have to give him a name, though. Without a name, I can't tell the story. So we'll call him Yankel Lichtman. Right? Nice name. Yankel Lichtman was born in the United States, but his family went on Aliyah when he was just a baby. And he grew up in Israel. And eventually, he became the head of a Mossad in Eretz Yisrael, Yeshiva, Kol, I don't know what it was exactly. And he never left Eretz Yisrael from the time they moved there. But his parents were American. He spoke a very fluent English. But he was part of the Jewish society. His yeshiva needed a new building. So until then, they managed. When they need a new building, what do? You come to America to go fundraising. So he's coming to America to raise money for his new building. Gets on the plane, flying to the United States. Sitting next to him is a non-Jewish fellow who is very friendly. And the guy starts asking, I see you're a rabbi. What do? He says, well, he has a yeshiva. What's a yeshiva? So he starts to explain to him, you know, we have a Torah that we got from Hashem at Har Sinai, and we've been keeping it all these years, and the yeshiva is an institution where we studied the Torah and tried to pass it on to the next generation. He said, and what are you coming to America for? I said, we need a new building. You know, we're coming to raise money. He said, you know, I think it's a beautiful thing how you keep your traditions and pass on from generation to generation. I'd like to give you a contribution to the building. Now, there are different shittas on that, but he's an Israeli, a Haredi, they won't take any money from a non-Jew. Our Rosh Hashiva paskins, by the way, that you can use it for secular purposes, you know, to pay for the dining room, you know, not to pay for the Beit Medrash, for Sefer Torah, but you could use it for other things. But he was, you know, hard line, don't take money from a non-Jew. So he has to explain to this guy that he's not going to take his money. So he said to him, listen, you know, I really appreciate your offer, but we believe that since this is a religious institution and it's a religious experience, really our people from our religion should be the ones who pay the bill. So he said, okay, you know what? Since I have a Jewish friend who lives in, I have to make up the name of the city too, because I don't know which city it is, but it's out somewhere where you wouldn't go. Let's say, Erie, Pennsylvania. Right? It's a city he would never have gone to on his rounds, you know, to raise money. Jewish fellow, he's a big philanthropist, and I bet he'd be happy to support you. So he gets off the plane, he says, this must be Min HaShemayim. I'm sitting next to some guy on the plane, he wants to give me money, I tell him no, he gives me a lead of another Jewish guy, I'm going to go to Erie, Pennsylvania, I'm going to make an appointment, I'm going to see this guy. So he gave him the guy's name and phone number. He called him up. He said he'd like to go visit him. He's here for Mizrahi. The guy says, fine, come by, give him a day, time. I'll see you such and such a day in the afternoon. So he goes to Erie, Pennsylvania, gets himself a motel, calls up the guy for his appointment. He says, by the way, the guy tells him, are you Orthodox? So he said, yes. He said, well, never mind, I don't give to Orthodox causes. He says, really? He says, yeah, the Orthodox are divisive. You know, I believe that, you know, in unity and you know, in pluralism, and you guys are trying to split the Jewish people, and I have nothing to do. I have stopped giving to Orthodox institutions, and you will not get a nickel. You're wasting your time. Don't bother. So he says, no, this is crazy. He's sitting next to a guy on the plane, gives him the name, the lead. There's got to be some Eshkan. Maybe it's not for money. Maybe he's there for a different purpose. So he said, okay, listen, if that's the way you feel, I respect your feeling. I don't agree with you, but I respect your feelings. But can I come in? I'm in town. Can I come and see you anyway? And I'm not going to ask you for money. He says, all right, if you want to. You know, I gave you an appointment, and you know, you're here. I'm not going to say no. You could come. So he comes, and the guy has a factory, comes in, a fancy office, you know, three layers of secretaries and receptionists till he finally gets to the office, plush. The guy's obviously doing very well. So he comes in, he doesn't know what he's there for. Right? He's not getting any money, like, what's he going to do? So he finally starts schmoozing with him. He asks, so tell me something about your background. I guess you must have come to America after the war and you built this up. He says, actually, no. He says, I came to America before the war. And we came with a lot of money. So my father was a very successful businessman in Europe. And he was able to get out of Europe in the 1930s and reestablish himself here in the United States. And I inherited the business. So he says, oh, really? Your father was, you know, as a tracker, was always successful in Europe. So he said, well, no, you see, my father came from, you know, really struggled for most of his life. And it was just to put a piece of bread on the table. And things went from bad to worse. He tried one business, he tried another business, nothing worked out for him. At one point in life, he told me he was very depressed. He was at the end of his rope when there was a fellow in the town who had faith in my father. And told him, listen, I have a building. You could use that building free, rent free, until you get on your feet, and I'll lend you a sum of money to help you start up this new business venture, and you'll pay me back whenever you can pay me back. I'm sure it'll work out. So my father was energized by this, and he had some capital. He started another business, and this one was Matzliach. Eventually, he paid the guy back, and he bought the building from him, and he bought other buildings, and this was the business we, you know, transplanted to the United States. It's very interesting. He says, so then the fellow says, why don't you tell me a little bit about yourself? So I said, where are you from? He says, well, you know, I was born in New York. And we, wait. The guy said, well, no, I didn't mean that, but your parents, your family, where are they from? So he says, well, my father was from a town in Lithuania named such and such. The guy stops for a minute and says, what did you say your name was? And he says, Yanko Lichtman. So how'd you get that name? He says, I'm named after my grandfather. Your grandfather lived in this town in Europe? He says, yes. So your grandfather is the one who gave the building to my father. The one that you're named after, that's the grandfather. Anyway, he got $2 million for his building. Despite the fact that he was Orthodox. But here, listen to what happened. He was following the halacha as his psak was, and he turned down a donation. You would think by turning down a contribution, you're making your job harder. Now, I don't know how much money this guy in the plane would have given him, but I could guarantee you that it would not have been $2 million. Probably a few hundred dollars, maybe $1,000 maximum. By turning down, by doing what he thought was right, al pi Torah, following his psak, and turning down the money, that's why this guy gave him the name of this Jewish friend of his, and ultimately it pays for his building. Now, I'm not guaranteeing you that this is going to happen every time you do the right thing. But That's how a Kaddish Baruch Hu works. When a person tries to outsmart a Kaddish Baruch Hu and do something improper to try and achieve his ends, often the thing that he did is exactly what leads to his downfall. And when you follow what a Kaddish Baruch Hu wants you to do, very often the thing that you do that seems to be working against you turns out in the long run to be precisely the factor that works in your favor. Maybe not as dramatically as this fellow on the plane, the Uncle Lichtman, or whatever his name really was, and not as dramatically as Esther and Mordechai, but in little ways or big ways, this often is what happens.